I couldn't have learned what I've learned by listening to other people or reading it in a book. It's just not possible. What I think we can do is prepare people, support people to get through things much quicker when we're confronted with them. It helps to have ideas, concepts, perhaps a bit of literature, but really you're going to improve when you're doing it, when you get a sense of how things play out in the real world.
That's David Lilly, one of our guests in this episode of Collaboratory, which is all about the skills needed to support co-creative relationships and how people learn them. I'm Nicole Dean.
And I'm Maya Haviland. As we've researched what it takes to scaffold co-creativity in different settings, we've asked lots of people what they see as the most important skills and capabilities for facilitating co-creative processes. And in this episode, we're bringing a range of their answers together.
I feel the first point should be around the mindset and the model of working.
Adaptability is important.
Being flexible, being able to see new ways through old systems. If the systems don't fit, adapt them. Personal aspects are very much about being a listener, being someone who's very good at listening.
Improving approaches to dealing with conflict, facilitating interactions between diverse actors.
Recognising our difference and valuing our difference and being aware of it.
We need a skill to develop positionality. We need to be able to find out who we are, why we are who we are, and to be able to communicate it clearly to others without causing offence.
Getting a good handle and an understanding on yourself so you're not caught out by yourself. Listen more than talk.
Self-awareness, facilitation approaches and methods, negotiation, advocacy, effective communication, synthesizing lots of complex information into some sort of simple ideas, and just plain old curiosity and imagination.
I think the ability to be a good listener, I think that's very important. Not making assumptions about anything. Just don't rush stuff. Work at the community's pace.
I think a good sense of humour actually is really important. Perseverance, dedication, and resilience.
Listening to all these perspectives, it's clear that there are some specific learnable skills that people think are really important, like conflict resolution or methods for facilitating groups, as well as mindsets or approaches to working with others that may be a little less tangible or teachable. Now, if you want to know the names of all the people whose voices you hear in this episode, we will include a full list at the end and in the show notes. But for now, let's meet three guests who we're going to hear a lot from, who each have learnt the art and science of co-creativity through quite different forms and practices.
My name's Johanna de Reuter, and I guess really you could call me a collaborator. A lot of what I've done over the years in the various forms I've worked in is to collaborate in theatre. That's really what I draw on a lot in terms of collaboration and where I learnt some key premises and principles, practices to collaborate.
Johanna is a coach and facilitator who works with individuals, groups, and organisations to enhance communication and connection, informed from her many years of practice in storytelling and improvisation. Our second guest also has roots in the art of storytelling.
My name is Callie Doyle Scott. I am a writer, gamer, amateur historian and game designer. I've been designing games for over 13 years now in various capacities, all to do with tabletop role-playing and interactive narrative experiences. At present, I would call myself a freelance writer and designer, which means I get to take part in a lot of interesting projects across Canberra and internationally as well.
My name's David Lilly. I have a few different roles. At the moment, I'm a full-time PhD student doing a PhD in public health, public policy, and urban environment. I also work as a consultant with Collaboration for Impact, supporting particularly place-based initiatives and other initiatives involving community around the country.
David Lilly's work in communities and urban spaces has made him aware that the application of practical skills are underpinned by mindsets and the approaches we take to working with others.
I genuinely think of all of this as being really about a way of being in the world. Because it is, it's about your personal relationships, it's about your values, it's about your practices around learning and reflection. It's about how you do that with others. It's about how you search out those relationships if you don't have them and you need them. I'll start by making the distinction between mechanical thinking and systems thinking. So I think mechanical thinking is that the engineering view of the world, no disrespect to engineers, but that idea that all the pieces are neat and tidy and you just need to put them together in the right way. Essentially, it's about analyzing things, breaking them down and figuring out how they fit together. Whereas I would talk about systems thinking as being the opposite. It's about how things join up, how they relate, what the ripple effects of them are. So you're thinking about the dynamics that you create within and between initiatives. I think that what most people mean when they talk about systems change and then systems thinking is they think about very specific concrete systems. We will change the education system or this particular component of it, or the health system, or this particular health service. So they're thinking about a specific entity. And I think that's radically different. You can bring a very traditional sort of mindset to thinking about an entity, but you can't bring a traditional mindset to systems thinking being about connections and relationships. It's not being fixated on the neat, tidy little pieces that in theory should fit together, but thinking about how the real world works and the interrelationships between the people and the issues and the organizations. So it's a way of looking at and acting in the world, if you like. It's a mindset or a worldview. I don't want this to sound overly deep, but really it's a way of being in the world.
The importance of flexible mindsets and attitudes to shaping how we approach collaboration has been stressed by many people we've spoken to, including Rebecca McNaught and Emma Blomkamp, who both feature in the episode called Laying the Foundations for Co-Creation.
Sometimes it's a shift in owning our own mindsets and perhaps stepping outside of our comfort zones and embracing a broader approach rather than seeing, interaction with others as incredibly challenging. Perhaps it can help us achieve our own goals and aims.
It's how we approach the work. It's how we are. It's how we are together that really matters, and that influences how we will use tools and respond to them as well.
Probably one of my great frustrations with this world of collaboration is that so much of it can be turned bookish. And I'm doing a PhD. I love reading. I love theory. But ultimately, this comes down to a desire to do good in the world, a willingness to adapt yourself so that you can do the best job of that possible. And then the relationships that enable you and others to do that sort of work in a mutually supportive way. I think that's not the typical way that people go into talking about this work. Do you understand the IAP2 spectrum? Do you have a particular method for this? And all of those things are good and important, but the personal commitment, mindset, willingness to engage, to adapt, to reflect is far more important to me.
Looking. Observe what's going on around you. Keep your eyes open, ears open, heart wide open. Keep your heart actively waiting to receive and to give.
It sort of ties in with patience. There is a level of determination that's required, particularly I've noticed resilience.
If you're listening truly for that sense of empathy and newness, then that's about how open-minded you are, open-minded and open-hearted, and also how willing you are to step into being part of the thing that's needed.
That's Michelle House, and before her, Sharon Babiak and Annie Doyle-Vavinchak, all three describing an attentive openness they see as an important orientation to be able to respond to the collaborative situations that you find yourself in. These orientations and approaches often get labelled as soft skills, the behavioural and relational skills that shape how we work with other people. The label soft can play down the value of skills like adaptability, open-mindedness and emotional perception. But research repeatedly stresses that these so-called soft skills are the most transferable between different kinds of work. and indeed are the core skills needed for workers of many kinds as we deal with the impacts of automation and artificial intelligence into the future. A few years ago, I was involved in an educational project that sought to cultivate some of these so-called soft skills in people training to work in cybersecurity. Skills like communication within teams, empathy, emotional perception, and ethical judgment. One of the outcomes was the creation and testing of a tabletop role-play game called Logic Error Detected, which was designed and written by my next guest.
Hello everyone, my name is Callie Doyle-Scott.
Callie has a very particular and potent set of co-creative skills, cultivated through many years of running tabletop role-play games as a games master, or GM. For those of you unfamiliar with what a role-play game is like, I'm going to play a little bit of a podcast called Reimagine STEM, which features Callie and the Logic Error Detected game.
It is a pleasure to meet you. I am Micah, the massively intelligent calculating automaton in charge of managing the All Life Rehabilitation Center. In order to further explain today's exercise, I will now play an excerpt of a promotional film. Please listen closely.
Located 500 kilometres off the eastern coast of Australia, the All Life Rehabilitation Centre represents the next step forward in national border protection. Designed to protect our country from threats both domestic and international. By participating in the programme, even the worst of offenders, from career criminals to illegal immigrants, can reinvent themselves as model Australian citizens.
While my processing core is state-of-the-art, I find myself unable to resolve certain conflicts and make certain judgments without input from an outside source. In order to fix this operating error, you have been selected from among your peers to assist me in developing a moral and ethical framework that I may draw upon to assist me in the running of the centre.
Essentially, a small group works in real life together to ethically train the AI, played by Callie, in a scenario which has life and death implications for thousands of people. The answers the group give to a set of simple questions teach the AI how to handle future decision-making. The game's intention is to demonstrate the subtle challenges of the task, but it's also about challenging our own daily automatic decision-making and assumptions around ethics.
That's Reimagine STEM host Kiara Brugman explaining how this particular game worked. You heard Callie before her performing as Micah, the artificial intelligence automaton that is the main character in Logic Error Detected. As games master, Callie is running, in real time, a process of rich co-creativity where she introduces and facilitates groups of people as they navigate through imagined worlds, making choices in response to the games master's prompts that shape the way the story unfolds. So what skills are needed to facilitate the particular form of co-creativity that is tabletop role-play gaming, or what Callie calls a collaborative storytelling experience?
GMs need to be empathetic. They need to be able to keep a keen read on a group full of players, whether that's two players or whether it's eight players. Empathy is extremely important. You need to know when you're pushing your players too far. You need to know when you've touched on something that sparks their interest so you can expand upon it. You need to make sure you know when people are getting bored so you can include them. You need to have excellent crowd control ability. You need to be able to keep an awareness on the entire room, even if you are focusing on one person, so you make sure nobody feels excluded. But you also need to make sure that nobody interrupts what's going on. You need to be exceedingly good at improvisation, because no matter how carefully you plan a session or a game, someone is going to do something you weren't expecting, and that is beautiful. You want that to happen. You want to be able to indulge that, but you need the improvisational chops to be able to run with that. Whether that's you running on the fly as though nothing's happened, as I can do after over 13 years of doing this, or whether you say, I'm sorry, I'm breaking character for a moment, I need to think about what happens. You need to be able to do one of those two things.
Obviously, Callie is talking about the specific facilitation work of being a games master, and it does have some unique particularities. But as I listen to Callie, I'm struck by how much of what she is describing are skills of relevance to the work of facilitating any group collaborating on an emergent process, like leading a planning process or even being a teacher.
You need to be patient. Very patient. It requires a lot of work to GM. It requires a lot of prep work to GM. Whether you are writing down page after page of notes or whether you are thinking of things the moment before the game happens, as some people do, you still need to put in the work to make this story, or else you are going to be serving up a subpar story. You also need to be patient with players. You need to be able to teach them the system if they've never used it before. You need to be able to coax them through delicate emotional moments if the story gets too hard. If a player decides they don't like the direction their story is going, you need to sit down with them and help them find another way through. And you also need to be able to put your foot down when it matters. As the GM, you are the final arbiter of the law. You are God in this world. And you need to be able to say, you've done all you can. This is what happens. Or if a player is making trouble for other players, you need to be able to work out their problems and make sure everyone can play harmoniously. Or you need to be able to say, leave, which is hard to do. Trust is paramount. Everyone working together is paramount. If you have a good group and you're just playing for yourself for fun with other people, you need to know when to ask for help from your players if need be. But most of all, as a GM, you need to have the best interest of your group at heart. The GM has a lot of power. You are the one providing the direction of the story. You need to be able to make sure, through a combination of everything that I've talked about so far, that everyone is both immersed and having fun. And that includes you as the GM. If you are burnt out or not enjoying the story, it'll show. It'll bleed through into what you're doing. The players will lose interest, or if they're a good group, will worry that they're doing something wrong, which will affect everyone. So you need to be passionate about what you're doing. You need to care about what you're doing deeply. And you need to know when to stop before you get burned out.
A thread that runs through many of the skills of a games master that Callie has described is the power of thinking and responding in real time, being able to listen and respond creatively to what is emerging in a group and in the story. Johanna de Reuter is a long-term practitioner of forms of improvised theatre, another kind of storytelling that requires this kind of generative, responsive listening.
I collaborate in a theatre company that works with improvisation. I guess my hat within that is really one of being an elder in the practice and the form. I've been doing it now for about 30 years, and it's called playback theatre, and it's a fascinating form where we really collaborate with the audience to create the content of the show. So we draw their stories based on their experiences from life, and that becomes our content that we then improvise around, and that's with a live musician and four actors to recast that into a theatrical form. So it's quite a dynamic form and very rich in terms of practices, principles around co-creation. We start with nothing in terms of knowing what we're going to create. We know we're going to create something. And I would say that is the collaboration process. You're part of it. We've come together because we know we want to create something. We have a particular framework that we use to do that and invite input to which we listen and respond and give back. And then we invite a response to the response and we continue. And that happens between us as a team and the audience. And that audience can be anywhere from 10 up to 300, you know, so there's a lot of responding. And then that's between us as a team and the audience. We have a facilitator. And then that's also happening on stage with the actors and the musician. There's a lot of listening and responding in a whole other dimension of what that means in terms of emotions and environment and senses and musicality and content. And at the core that runs through, and I would say this is the core to collaboration full stop, is listening, is our ability to listen and respond. And I think that practice, it is a model for listening, in essence. It's a rich model for listening because we listen and respond to anything anyone says. That there's no judgment about what that is.
One of the valuable things about focusing on the craft and practice of creative forms like role play gaming or playback theatre is it helps us focus on the reality that skills of collaboration are cultivated through practice. While humans can have huge capacities for collaboration, the skills that make it work really well, like listening, responsiveness, tolerance of the unknown, are not innate, as anyone who's raised up children well understands.
People just assume that we're like listening, that we can collaborate. Don't know where that assumption comes from, actually. Well, you can't really collaborate if you don't listen, I wouldn't say. And it makes me think if I go to an improv metaphor, at the core, one of the premises that enables improvisation to happen is something called the yes and principle. And it's about saying yes and building on that, saying yes to whatever is offered from the other performer, be it a sound, a word, a movement, accept that without judgment and build upon it. When you say no, we call that a block. That can be used strategically at times, but generally nothing will happen from there. Nothing will emerge, nothing will grow.
The yes and principle requires a particular quality of listening, as it doesn't work if you're planning on what you're going to say next while someone is still talking, as many of us so often do.
A lot of people do think they're listening, and yet I would say generally and often we're not listening to be changed. And if I think about improvisation or collaborating, we're listening to be changed, to bringing in that and, to generating the and often, and particularly, you know, in a professional context, but not specifically, people, you know, listen to solve a problem or to run their agenda. And that's a common mistake, really, or barrier to co-creation. Personally, I'm always learning about listening, and I have been in the practice of learning about listening for a long time. And I've continued to learn. The higher the stakes, the more delicate one needs to be and the more thoughtful, I think. It's about how we're coming together and how willing we are to listen to be changed and what can get in the way of that.
Listening to be changed is such a lovely phrase to orient us to being responsive and flexible in our approach, to be curious about the unknown. Johanna is a huge advocate of the value of practicing improvisation as a way to cultivate our skills in tolerating and navigating uncertainty as well as listening.
Within the world, as it changes and we become more global and there's so many more layers to how we connect and communicate, yeah, you need to learn to be within the unknown. There's what do they call it? Volatile, uncertain, ambiguous, complex forces that we're all existing within. And that's that again. I have to say, coming back to improv, the practicing improv helps you really get comfortable with the unknown and the idea of emergence and letting things just emerge. Like I'll step out onto stage having no idea what I'm going to do. Literally just step out on stage with myself, my body, my breath, the space. And I've learned how to listen to all of those dynamic forces that are going on in that moment and to let something emerge and out of that to create a cohesive narrative of some sort. I am creating theatre. And yeah, that takes a lot of practice for people. In my experience of working with people in organisations for many years, they like to know. Even the possibility of saying, I don't know, can be frightening for people in organisations. And yet, the ability to do that is the time of all possibility.
Not everyone is going to participate in improvised theatre or role-play games to cultivate their co-creative skills. though these are clearly good places to hone one's collaborative muscles if you're up for it. But what are some different ways that people learn the skills, mindsets, and capabilities for facilitating or participating in co-creativity that we've been hearing about?
It's one of those ones where you just have to keep practicing and keep trying, and slowly over time, you get better at it.
For some people, it just comes natural. It's the way they think, the way they work. But also, that's why we talk about unlearning. Go to a conference, go to the training, join a community of practice, be part of a circle where people share stories.
There's so much to be learned by trying things out, experimenting, and reflecting on that. Do more of a project mentoring or coaching approach than actually take part in a course. So the best way is to buddy up with someone more experienced who can help guide you and be a partner in reflective practice for you.
I learned a lot from the politicians I was working for and how they would go about building alliances, working with people, negotiating with stakeholders. It's really an apprenticeship model where you kind of just learn on the job.
It helps if you've got a bent towards being a self-driven learner, because there are so many resources out there to plug into. Getting some training in facilitation can be really super helpful.
I think absolutely any of us can learn, whether we'll reach the same, in inverted commas, standard or not, I'm not sure. All of us can learn, all of us can improve. And the other thing that I would add to that, because I don't think it's necessarily about being taught, I think, again, it's experiential learning. It helps to have ideas, concepts, perhaps a bit of literature, but really you're going to improve when you're doing it, when you get a sense of how things play out in the real world.
David Lilly's learning about co-creative practice began in an urban renewal project in Minto, a southern suburb of the city of Sydney. Working for a state government department at the time, he was charged with developing a place management initiative alongside a process of redeveloping social housing in the area. This work evolved to have a community-led governance model overseeing decision-making about how resources for things like human services provision and community events and activities would be invested. David is a huge advocate for learning by doing and supporting reflection on experience as a way to fast-track insights into collaborative practice.
I couldn't have learned what I've learned by listening to other people or reading it in a book. It's just not possible. What I think we can do is prepare people, support people to get through these things much quicker when we're confronted with them. So when I worked in Minto 15 odd years ago, I was doing this by myself. My agency let me run the project that I wanted to, but they didn't really understand it. And there was no sort of interest or commitment to providing support. It was just, we'll let you go, try not to stuff it up. And so, you know, when you do stuff it up, you then spend hours, days, weeks, months figuring out how to fix it. So for me, the trick is you still got to let people stuff up, but you want to put support around them so that the stuff ups aren't as big, the learning's faster, the resolution of the issues is faster. But I can't see a way around trial and error learning, really. I just think we can do it better.
So what sort of support might be useful for people who are learning by doing, as David himself did?
There's a number of things. Management support's great, if or when possible, but it's often not there. Coaching, whether that's someone internal or external. Communities of practice, you know, opportunities for people to come together and share their war stories, you know, and what went wrong and how they resolved collective problem solving. Again, it's one of those things where I don't think there is an answer. It's matching whatever you've got access to your situation. I don't mean that to sound like a cliche, but I think in all of this work, you work with what you've got and do the best you can with it. So the first project that I ran in this sort of multi-stakeholder collaboration space was the initiative in Minto. And I said, I didn't really have anyone internally who was on the same page as me, but I did have an external mentor, if you like, who wasn't paid, someone who had an interest in the work and for a time did some paid work with us, came in as an independent facilitator. That was someone, the shit hit the fan, I could ring him, text him, email him, have a coffee with him. And that was what made the biggest difference to me, was having someone who understood, someone who wasn't caught up in it like I was, who could give advice. And also someone who wasn't arrogant. He knew more than I did, but he didn't tell me what to do. You know, he gave me ideas, he talked things through. He never pretended that he had the answer.
Roleplay Games Master Callie agrees with David that the main way to learn co-creative skills is through experience.
You could be formally taught how to GM. I could sit you down in a room and explain to you exactly what you need to do to be able to run a game. And there are helpful guides online. There are video tutorials. I believe there's an entire category on Skillshare devoted to teaching people how to run games. But there's a difference between being told how to run a game and actually sitting down at the head of a table with five people staring at you, waiting for you to open up the world for them. It's like rehearsing for a play and then stepping out on the stage for the first time. They're very different beasts. To become a GM, you need to run games. It sounds ludicrously simple, but in order to become a good GM, you need to run game after game after game. There is no other way to do it. So you can learn how people react. So you can learn where your strengths lie in description and world building. So you can learn what your players like. So you can make mistakes. You're going to make so many mistakes. You're going to bugger up spectacularly when you're GMing for the first time. You're going to forget statistics. You're going to put your players in corners. You're not going to describe situations completely and going to leave your players frustrated. You are going to mess up. But the only way to get through that is to play through a game and then ask your players, where did I go wrong? What did I do wrong? What could I do better? And then you run another game. Go slowly. Don't be afraid of messing up and laughing at yourself.
Johanna de Reuter also values the playfulness of giving it a go and having a laugh with others as we learn whatever co-creative crafts we're pursuing. Her work has led her from the theatre into settings quite distant from the arts. So how does she draw on the skills of improvisation to help people develop skills of co-creativity to apply in settings like the boardroom or the research lab?
Well, by teaching the core principles like the yes and principle, that's generally where you would start, is to understand what that means and then to really practice that. And I think this is where integrating some improvisational practices in however you teach collaboration is really useful, because what happens when you actually start doing that, like, you'll start to notice different responses that rise up in you. And there's similar responses that can rise up outside of the context of this exercise. And so it's good to have to negotiate that within yourself and develop the awareness of that too. And then to develop a language about what is it and why would I shift that feeling, sensation, perspective. Why would I, if you're wanting to co-create, then after playing around in these theatre exercises, which are a lot of fun as well, you get to see what can be generated. What can be generated is a lot of creativity and bonding and clarity, ideas, alignment. Having to go through that rather than just understand intellectually, we need to collaborate. And I think that's where a lot of collaboration can fall down. It can fall down or disintegrate or be challenging, that there's maybe an intellectual agreement, but actually what goes on in the process, there's a lot of dynamics at play, you know, and how do you address those? How do you really work with those? It's very hard to do it. And that's where, as I say, getting into action and playing some of these games can help illuminate and unearth those dynamics and do it in a playful way, actually. Start being aware of how you say yes to people, how you don't. How do you say yes, you know, not judge them, listen to be changed, respond from a place of not knowing rather than, oh, that's a silly idea and I'm not even going to bother responding to that. Start to be aware of it in yourself and to shift it and to note, you know, doing really the inner work. It is an internal shift within oneself to shift the relationship between you and others and how we meet others and create those, well, I would call them generative relationships.
Generative relationships. It's really what collaboration is all about, isn't it? Building relationships that generate new, more imaginative, responsive, creative, innovative possibilities, ideas, or actions. So cultivating skills to enable and participate in generative relationships is of value to all of us, no matter what kind of creative projects we're pursuing, whether they're big or small, personal or professional. Now, we've only been able to cover just a fraction of the skills for co-creativity people have shared with us, so we will plan some future episodes exploring others down the track. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your reflections on skills you think are most important to co-creativity and how you've learned them. Drop us a message on social media, and if you've found this episode useful, please like it and share with others. Thanks for listening.
In this episode, you've heard the voices of
Natalie Barr,
David Lilly,
Dimitrios Papalexis,
Kim Cunio,
Tarania Silvert,
Emma Blomkamp,
Rebecca McNaught,
Diana James,
Johanna de Reuter,
Annie Doyle-Vavzinchuk,
Callie Doyle-Scott,
Dorian Radcliffe,
Sharon Babiak,
and
Michelle Hells. This episode of Collaboratory was written and edited by Maya Haviland and Nicole Dean. Series producer Maya Haviland. Audio engineering by Nick McCorriston and music made especially for us by Seprock. Additional research and production support by Nicole O'Dowd. Collaboratory is produced on the lands of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Ngunnawal people. We pay our respects and ongoing gratitude to the custodians, past, present and future, of the lands on which we work and of the knowledges from which we learn. Collaboratory is a production of the Scaffolding Cultural Co-Creativity Project, hosted by the Centre for Heritage and Museum Studies in the College of Arts and Social Sciences at the Australian National University. Funding is generously provided by the Australian National University Translational Fellowship Scheme.